Shalom. Welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this, all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can reach us at genesis123.co or follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, where we're also going to share some exciting opportunities. And also, please feel free to share this with others who will also find it of interest. As I was preparing for today's conversation, I actually was trying to remember how on earth I connected with David Weiss. I don't really know. It's a social media phenomena. We friended each other. We follow each other. There's a lot in common. And I've always enjoyed being in touch, although full disclosure, like many social media relationships, we've actually never met in person. Though this is not the first time that I've had David as part of a program and conversation with Inspiration from Zion. If you've been following for a while, you'll recall that in the midst of the period over 2.5-3 years that Israel had 5 national elections, I did a lot of conversations about those elections. And David, because I find him just very thoughtful and insightful, I invited him to join one of those conversations about the election, who we were voting for at that time, what were the issues. And what's interesting, and it's nice to have David back as part of the conversation today on something that's very different. I suspect that it's fair to say that if you asked David, and maybe we could start off by asking that question, would we rather be having a conversation about political upheaval and divisiveness or 14 months into a war that's affecting all of us? I kind of guess that we would rather have that political upheaval, even though that wasn't very good for any of us either. David is married and the father of 4 sons, like my daughter. He grew up in Manhattan and moved to Israel in 2008. He works in fintech here in Israel. And in addition to his professional career, his hobby, which I think is more than a hobby, it's kind of like a passion, is baseball. And then and David is a coach, which we're going to talk about as well here. And I kind of decided before the conversation began, we're going to be calling this episode From the Foxhole to the Dugout, because David was sharing with me the other day some of his unique stories. So that began a year ago after the war, a little over a year ago when the war started. So David, I'm really glad to get to see you, to have you back, and as always, to get your insight. And people can follow you on we'll put the links wherever we need to put links in the show notes, so people can also follow your insightful activities as well. But
thank you.
Welcome back to Inspiration from Zion.
Thank you so much for having me back on the show. Last time we spoke, as you said, was a few years ago. We were discussing, I remember, Naftali Bennett and the Israeli elections. And to answer your question, I think I'd rather go back to those times where things were peaceful, but we had a crazy election system going on and countless elections. I'd rather go back to that than the war that we're currently in. But yeah, times are just different. And, you know, God has his plans and we're just part of it.
Yeah. This episode, I think you and I discussed it getting ready for and setting up today's conversation. I think that recently, with last week's episode, I crossed the threshold. I don't think anything in Israel will ever be the same in the sense that we can go back. But I have consciously felt that over the last year plus, 13 months now, every episode of Inspiration from Zion has been somewhat connected to the war. But I kind of crossed the threshold, and I think that not every conversation that I will have forever is going to be flavored by the war that we're in the midst of and the terror attack that we were all subject to October 7th of 2023. But I don't want to be speaking about only war-related things. So this conversation actually kind of helps me pivot because we're going to do a little bit of both. David, oh, and I forgot to mention it. It's very significant. You live in Carne Shomron, which is in
Yes.
Samaria, about as similar north in Samaria as I am south in Judea, here in Ephrat. So that's also significant in our story and what we're going to be talking about today. Let's start. We're talking about war. You had an interesting, I think that's a reasonable word, experience when the massacre took place and the war began. Tell us about that, October 7th, a year ago.
So it's good that you mentioned that because I guess I'm a good segue guest to go from exclusively talking about war to talking about war and just life in Israel. So I guess like many Israelis, my story begins on October 7th, 2023. The difference between my story and I think many other stories that you've probably have people on your show is that I wasn't sent to Gaza. I wasn't sent to the border with Lebanon. I actually spent my entire time here in Samaria. So my day begins with my phone vibrating. I was getting alerts about incoming rockets. Fire.
But wait a
Now,
minute, David, let me interrupt you right there. You're also
yes,
an Orthodox Jew. It was a
correct.
Saturday. Typically, our
Yes.
phones are not on. Why was your phone even with you?
So, good question. So, the reason I had my phone on me is because I'm a member of what's called in Hebrew the Kitat Kohanut. It's a first responder security squad. So, from the moment I joined that squad, one of the things I had to change about my life is I always have to have my phone on me, including on Saturdays and even on Yom Kippur, the high holidays. It doesn't matter. I always have to have my phone on me just in case. And so that was something that changed about my life even before the war started. And what it means to be on the Kitat Kohanut or the security squad is in my house, I have an M16, a vest, a helmet, an army uniform. So just in case, I'm always prepared. So in this, so when the rocket fire started early in the morning, I was getting alerts and I was told, you can go to synagogue, but make sure you have your M16 on you. So that's how my day started. There's several other members of the squad who pray in my synagogue. And shortly thereafter, we were told the situation in the south is actually very serious. There seems to be some sort of a massive terrorist infiltration. Everyone, we're going on full alert. What does that mean? Everyone go home, put your uniform on, get your vest, get your helmet,
Wow.
make sure you have all of your magazines on you. We're on the highest alert possible.
Were
And
you
when
getting
the
rockets at that time in the morning? Were you getting
so
air sirens?
we actually didn't get any sirens in our area. So the alerts I got were not for sirens in my area. It was for the general south. They realized this wasn't a regular, okay, a couple of rockets fire here and there. This was a massive barrage, and that's why we had to be alerted, even though geographically we're not particularly close to the south. And so they told us, don't come back to the synagogue as regular. Instead, you're going to divide up into groups of two, get into your cars, and start patrolling. Okay, you're starting to patrol the entire town. And during this time, we were told there actually was a terrorist attack in the town of Beit Aryeh. If I had to guess, we're talking about a half an hour drive from us. And so we started to worry that what was happening in the south was not something just contained to the south, but it was something much wider. There were all sorts of alerts about potential terrorist attacks in the area. And so we realized, without even being told, we all sort of instinctively realize the country's at war. Whether the politicians say so, whether the army officially says so, all the guys who are in the squad are like, okay, this is a really big deal, what's going on. And so as I'm in the car, I'm with one of my friends who's part of the security squad, one of my neighbors, and I get a phone call from my regular army reserve unit saying everyone has to come. We have to sign on our gear and we're going to take over the front lines in the Jenin slash Tulkarim area. For those
Which
of
is in, which is, yeah, go ahead. That's
Yeah,
exactly
so
where I'm
today, for
from.
those who aren't familiar exactly where that is, it's north of where I live. It's also part of Samaria. Jenin is like the northernmost major Palestinian city in Samaria. A little bit south then to the west of that is Tulkarim, and that's where we were going to be taking over frontline duties. So we were told, report as soon as you can. Make sure you have your gear and let's go. We have to take over the front line because those guys are going to be replacing other. I don't think they are actually replacing. I think it was a tank unit, if I'm not mistaken. And they had to, I think, go up to the border with Lebanon. So everyone, full mobilization, everyone's moving. But I actually had a problem. I'm actually right now in the middle of a patrol. But on the other hand, I'm told to leave to join my unit. So I have this sort of dilemma. What exactly do I do? What's more important? So I called up one of my officers, explained to him the situation, and he said, "Do not leave. Don't move from where you are right now." He said, "The fear
Officers
is
in the army, one of the people
correct."
to whom you report. Okay.
Exactly. One of my commanding officers, he's the head of, in Hebrew it's called a pluga, which in English translates to company.
Yeah.
So he's the company officer, I guess in English that's the CO. And so he told me, don't leave until the unit that's going to come to reinforce Carnet Chambrun arrives. Once you know they're arriving, then leave and go to the base that you have to report to, which is it's it was the eventually I get to Mutzav Reichan, but the base I had to go at the time was Mevo Dotan, all areas of the northern Samaria. So he said, don't leave until they come. So long story short, later that evening, I drove up, and that's how I got to my base that I was stationed at for the next 4 months.
Now I have another qu technical question. So you said, which is very interesting, because I know my son-in-law is here in the Kitat Kohanut in the rapid response team. He has an M16 like you, but he doesn't have a uniform. And he and my son is not on the Kitat Kohanut, were both called up that day, but they weren't in uniform. So when you left Karnei Shomron finally to go meet up with your unit, you were in uniform already. I assume, but did you take the Army issued M16 that's for use in your community, or did you have to go and pick up another weapon to go into military service?
Good question. I'll keep it short. Long story was, I took my weapon to the front lines, and then later, when things calmed down, I switched it. So I had to
Got
come
it.
back, give them the weapon, and I signed on one the next day with my unit. Because yes, normally you're not supposed to do it, but when the country is in a complete chaotic state and we realize it's a massive war, I wasn't going to say, okay, here's my gun, and now let me drive here to this base to get a gun and then drive around. I said, you know what? I got to protect my community. I then have to take over this front line, and then I'll figure out what to do with the gun later, which I did. So several
Sure.
weeks later, I resolved that issue.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, I had a conversation here with someone from Kibbutz Be'eri who was not on site that day, is a member of the rapid response team, did not take his gun with him, and he couldn't get back to Be'eri, so he called his neighbor, obviously somebody who's knows how to use a weapon, but not in the rapid response team, and instructed his neighbor how to get into his gun safe so at least someone would have that gun that day and be able to fight the terrorists.
Yeah,
Okay.
it was definitely a crazy day. I know there were a lot of issues with, guns being locked up and people not having access to them.
Right.
But everyone, I guess, has their own story with how they responded that day. And so in my case, I had to get to the front lines. And then what happened was, you see, normally when you take over the front lines, you have a briefing. But things were so chaotic and up in the air, there was no time to say, okay, everyone sit down. We're going to explain to you what's going on. They basically told us, okay, guys, who's done the front lines in this particular area in the past and who hasn't? So I raised my hand and said, I've done it. I did this frontline area in 2009. So I knew the area. And they said, okay, good. So you know the area? I said, yes. They said, are you familiar with the pillbox? There's a pillbox. For those of you who are not familiar, it's a sort of a tall guard tower. It's reinforced concrete, and it's often, you basically put them in strategic areas, and often at the bottom, you'll have like a mini base. So they said, we're going to send you to the pillbox. You'll be there for the next few days. So take all of your gear, and you're going to be guarding. And this pillbox is in the area that's between an Israeli Arab city called Baka al Garbia and the Palestinian side. There are a few towns. There's Baka al Sharkiya, Nazlat Isa, Zeta. And so basically, from October 8th for the next few days, I was there. And I'll tell you something, it was actually one of the most unnerving feelings I've ever had because, on the one hand, you've got an Israeli Arab city with roughly 30,000 people. And if you combine the different Arab towns on the Palestinian side, I think their populations combine for about 10,000 or so. And normally, what you do is our job is normally to make sure no one from the Palestinian side sneaks in and tries to cross into the Israeli side. But with
Right.
all that was going on, we weren't even sure where's the threat. Am I potentially, watching my, do I have to watch my backside, which is the Israeli Arab side? Do I have to, just look at the Palestinian side? It was something that was very unnerving. I could tell you, I actually slept, full gear on. I wouldn't even take off my shoes, even though there's a shower there. I wasn't going to shower. I was like, I'm going to be fully on duty because I didn't know. I mean, we're a small
You
group of
didn't know.
guys surrounded by tens of thousands of Arabs on both sides. You're just hoping, none of them decide, let's go storm this pillbox.
Yeah, we have pillboxes over here, and Without getting into the strategic sensitivity, God forbid if something like that were to happen, it would not end well.
Right. Yeah, because I mean, there's soldiers there and you're well armed and, you have what means to defend yourself. But if everybody comes, you're limited. So I had different stories. One of the absolutely crazy ones that I've really thought about a lot since then was one of the days I was at the top of the pillbox and I was doing the guard duty, and the siren goes off. There's incoming rocket fire from Gaza. And so what you do is you basically tell everyone, look, we can't do anything to prevent the rocket from coming in because we're just infantry soldiers there. So everyone get inside the pillbox, shut the door because it's reinforced concrete. It's actually a very safe place to be. So as I yell at the guys, come on, let's go, come in, close the door. As I yell, close the door, I hear a massive boom somewhere in the area, but I was looking down to make sure everyone was safe. I actually didn't see where it landed. So my initial feeling was, let me check the Israeli side, because I know that's essentially what they're aiming for. I was looking around for about 15, 30 seconds, whatever it was. I didn't see anything. I then looked over the Palestinian side. I didn't see anything. A police car actually then drove to the area saying, you're the highest, person. Did you see anything? I said, I didn't. But it turned out, because of social media and Telegram and how fast things move, we shortly thereafter found out from Palestinian Telegram it actually landed on the Palestinian side and killed a Palestinian man. And it
Interesting.
was something that I thought about a lot because this was around the time we were getting a lot of the details from the massacre of October 8th. And we realized that, I don't know the exact number, but it has to be dozens of Arabs were killed. The Arab Muslims were killed by Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the other groups that broke in. And now, in this case, a Palestinian man was killed by incoming Hamas rocket fire. I don't know the answer to this question, but something I've thought about for a while. How many Arabs were actually killed because of the Hamas atrocities and this war? Meaning the number of people that were killed essentially by their, I don't know, you want to call it their own side or by their co-religionists, it's actually a shockingly high number. And I don't know what the answer is, but something I've been very curious about since the start of the war.
So I want to take a break, but you lead to an interesting point in the at least as of the day that we're speaking, the most recent Iranian attack on Israel in October. The one casualty was also a Palestinian Arab, if I'm not mistaken, in Jericho, and I have a
Correct.
video of it. I think I put it on YouTube, but YouTube didn't like it because it violated policies, whatever. So YouTube took it down. But you saw a massive hunk. It wasn't even the whole missile because I've been up close to a whole missile. It was just a massive chunk of a missile that squashed somebody on the street, and it looked like a cartoon, like something not Bugs Bunny, Road Runner, and what's the other one? Mimi.
Oh, that you're asking me about my knowledge of
You know what
Looney
I mean,
Tunes.
but
Yes, I know there's
just these ridiculous things that happen, and it was, but yes, it's a very good point. And last thing before the quick break, it's very important to know. Part of the reason I asked the question about whether you had rockets that day on October 7th a year ago was you're significantly further away from Gaza than we are. We woke up to that and had that for most of the morning, Jerusalem. Quite a lot. We could hear the booms coming from Jerusalem as well. But you're a good bit further. You're probably 30 miles further north. So rockets coming at closest are being fired 70, 80 miles from Gaza to you, to where you are. Oh, no. Even further, because now you're in
Even
the
further,
northern part of
because on the
Samaria.
northern tip of Samaria,
You're
correct.
100, you're
That's
100 miles.
something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. David, fascinating conversation. We're going to come right back.
As remarkable and miraculous as Israel is, and its very existence a testimony to God's faithfulness, in many ways, Israel's like most other countries. Just as there are parents anywhere who have stronger and weaker parenting abilities, and adults become a product of situations in their lives that they cannot control, making their ability to raise and care for their own children even harder, that's true in Israel as well. The Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation is committed and takes the mandate seriously to care for the least of these, our brothers, our children. We're committed to bless and strengthen orphans and at-risk youth, to invest in them, to empower them, so that their future will be brighter than their past or their present. But Israel is unique in that there are always threats of war and terror which know no bounds. For children who come from homes that are not safe, Sometimes the very scary reality of living in a community that's not safe is too much to bear. We are committed to turning orphans and at-risk youth into children of promise. We fund a variety of programs to help those most in need as widely as we can. We invite and encourage you to join us today so that we can ensure their brighter tomorrow. Please visit genesis123.co to find out more and to send your love and most generous donation today.
To the extent that this is an enjoyable conversation, it's enjoyable. Is it traumatic for you to talk about this?
No, it's not. If anything, it's like healing, so to speak. You know, I realized I went through not the, you know, the most brutal parts of the war, but as I'll get into later in the story, I did see some quite a lot of action, and I think it definitely helps to talk about these things. So I appreciate these conversations.
Yeah. Okay. So you're in Northern Samaria. You're in a pillbox, not knowing which direction to be looking over which shoulder. And how are things unfolding there? What we were also on high alert, but I think also probably what happened, and tell me if I'm wrong, when you and others who were in Karnei Shomron as part of the rapid response team, everyone's pretty much of military reserve age. And I just remember thinking, oh my goodness, on October 7th, my son-in-law, the roads were super busy for a Saturday with people in uniform trying to get rides to wherever. And I thought, my goodness, who's left here? Was that an issue?
Yeah, that was definitely something they were worried about. That's one of the reasons I was told not to leave until the evening. And there were other issues that they've had to deal with in the long run, which is if you're part of your first responder security squad locally, and you're also part of a separate reserve unit, well, what's going to happen if something like this happens again? Now, I'm not going to get into all the military plans, but they have dealt with this issue. So you don't have a situation where the whole security team just leaves in a matter of hours, because it was definitely a large problem. So getting back to my story, in my case, so I was in the pillbox, I think for about 4 days, if I'm not mistaken, and then I continued doing regular frontline service. The general orders that we had were to patrol the area and to keep things quiet. Why is that? The army was really bogged down, obviously, in Gaza and, of course, in the northern border along, you know, the Lebanese border as well as Syria. So they wanted to make sure that most of the troops were there and specifically not in Judea and Samaria. It doesn't mean the Palestinians felt the same way when we said keep things quiet. For the next several weeks, I actually had some close calls. At one point or another, I had a Molotov cocktail thrown in my direction, general rock throwings. Pipe bombs hurled at me. So I had different stuff that happened. Thankfully, none of them were like too close. It was more of like the general area. But still, you know, I did have to deal with stuff. And I found in many ways it was more action packed than my regular army service that I had done about 15 years before. The only thing I could think of that was like a serious mission is there was a Palestinian terrorist who murdered an Israeli police officer in August 2023. And we were sent on a mission to destroy the house that he lived in. It was something, it's a common mission that you'll have once you find out who the terrorist is, et cetera. So that was, I guess, the only time I had a serious mission on the Palestinian side until mid-December when things changed. In mid-December, the army basically realized that throughout Judea and Samaria, there had been a massive buildup of weapons, and this was going on for years. And so rather than waiting for the terrorists to attack us, we said that we're going to be proactive and get to them first.
No, no, good. I'm on the edge of my seat.
Okay, so this brings me to the holiday of Hanukkah, the Jewish Festival of Lights, and the mission I had in Jenin. We were told that we're going to go on the largest military raid in Jenin in 20 years. I see you have a question.
Jenin, we need to make a note of, is a big hotbed
yes.
for terrorism. It's not just a large Palestinian Arab city. It's like a mecca of terror.
And the refugee camp in particular. Now, I'm not going to get into the particulars of why it's a refugee camp and the whole scam of why they're even considered refugees. But what's known as the refugee camp is a really nasty hotbed. And for years, the army was just like, we're not going to send in large numbers of troops, even though we know there's lots of weapons there. We know terrorists come from there because it's considered to be too dangerous. And then in December of 2023, they said, you know what? All gloves are off. There's nothing that's off limits for us. And we're going to send a massive force. I think we were about 1,500 troops, mostly
Wow.
reservists like me. And
Wow.
we're just going to take over the city, which we did in a matter of hours. And the goal was to go house to house, arresting as many terrorists as we can, confiscating weapons, terrorist materials like combat vests, uniforms, any communications
Uniforms, meaning
device.
Israeli army uniforms.
Yes, it's actually one of the scary things. Like I personally found uniforms on this operation. The number of uniforms that they have that they can dress up like Israeli soldiers and then commit terrorist attacks is shockingly high. So when you go and raid their house and you're like, hey, look at that. There's an army fleece, army pants. Like, where did you get this from? So we confiscate all of that stuff. We arrest those who need to be arrested. Long story short, when we left, we had lots of tables full of, guns, bullets, gun parts, walkie-talkies, you name it. We just had like tables and tables full of all of this stuff. And it was, very important operation to go on because it made the area a lot safer for everybody else.
Yeah.
And that brings me to what I had as my near-death experience. So as we're leaving Jenin, I'm getting into the armored vehicle. And all of a sudden, I hear boom, boom, boom. I hear bullets just hitting really close to my head. So as I'm getting going up the steps of the vehicle, I hear bullets like right by my head. I do what you're supposed to do, which is duck for cover, no matter where it is. You get shot at, first thing is duck for cover because you don't know where the bullets are coming from. So I literally dive across. I'm a machine gunner, so I like. I don't know how I did this. I somehow threw the machine gun in a way that didn't smash the faces of any of my guys in the car. And I'm so like I'm there like lying down on some of their legs. Some of the guys in the front got out. I guess we were able to figure out where it's coming from. They returned fire. And that's essentially how I left Janine, realizing that those bullets must have landed a couple of feet from my head. It was close. I definitely realized that, my life could have changed in an instant from that moment.
That was a bit of appropriate divine protection, but unfortunately, we've seen se several hundred instances in, since October a year ago where that's not the case, and people going in to do a operation or just finding themselves in the wrong place have ended up leaving behind a wife and four kids, and that's quite terrible.
Yeah, absolutely. So I realized that, God watched over me. There's a certain blessing we make in Hebrew, it's called Birkat HaGomel. It's
Right.
the blessing we make when we thank God for surviving a dangerous experience. So I was very lucky that weekend. I was let out of the army, so I was home for Shabbat for the first time in probably about a month. So I said that blessing in synagogue. And before Saturday, sorry, before I made that blessing, actually, I was home also on Friday. And I got to do something which I absolutely love, which is coach baseball. My second son, Ori, had a baseball tournament. Every year there's a Hanukkah baseball tournament. So
Oh.
I got out for that and I got to coach his team. And while I was there, like at that tournament, I realized, there's certain things that everyone, in these times will realize. You'll realize how important your family is to you, but there are also like other things you'll say, man, if I, died or if I was seriously injured, what would be the things I missed? And for me, one of the answers in my head was baseball. I said,
Wow.
like, if God forbid I would seriously injured, I couldn't coach, that would absolutely devastate me. So I made myself sort of two promises, and I'll get back to this later in the story. One of them is I wanted to go back to Poland where they have the Little League World Series qualifiers with Team Israel. That was one goal. And the other one was I wanted to help build a real baseball field in Carnei Shomron for the kids there. So I'll get back to that later in the story.
Well,
But
before we talk about this specifically, I wanted to ask, you were gone. This is now December. You're gone for most of 2 months. That wasn't the end of your reserve duty either. It's not like they let you out. You just got to come home at a good time for you to be able to do this shortly after having that near-death experience. But what with the four boys, what's it been like for your family? What's it been like for the kids? How and your wife, of course, having to be home by herself. We have all these stories, and I know my son-in-law who they just left the house is going back to his new unit, not talking about that today, but he leaves most of the week and leaves my wife and their four boys home all week, and I think it has a adverse effect, and I even think it may have an adverse effect when my grandsons go to the army because they will affiliate army with Abba not being home.
Yeah.
What's your
It's
experience been in your family?
so for starters, my wife Hani was absolutely amazing for the 4.5 months that I was away. Essentially, she had to be a single mom where I would come home periodically here and there, but most of the time she's holding down the fort, making sure the kids get to school, that dinner is ready. If a kid has a doctor's appointment, she's the one taking them. All the normal things that we would split up. Now she can't split up because I'm only coming home here and there. And it's difficult for her, for sure. And it's definitely difficult for the kids because, they don't have their father to go to for anything. And, it's
Right.
much more, and it's difficult for across the board for the family. What I will say is different about the Israeli army compared to the American army is in the American army, when you're sent abroad and you're on a tour of duty, I mean, you're gone for months at a time. There's no real concept of coming home. In the Israeli army, because you're not that far, like I was an hour drive away from home. So I was able to come home here and there. Like they could send me home for the weekend and then Sunday morning, I have to head back and continue, my guard duties. So that's definitely something that's beneficial, from the perspective of the Israeli army. So in the case of this story, so I continued my army service. I went back and we had, more of the regular guard duties that I was doing. But in addition, we continued doing these types of operations. So I actually went to Tul Karem, in particular Nur al-Shams, which is like a refugee camp, big terror hotbed. We jokingly will say, oh, it's the Palestinian explosives capital because they love planting their IEDs, their improvised explosive devices all over the place. And we did the same thing, searching for terrorist materials, weapons, things like that. The difference was when we were there, I heard a lot more explosions than when I was in Jenin. So I was there, and then by the end of February, things changed, and they started releasing a lot of the reservists. So I, when all was said and done, my 4.5 months of Army Reserve duty had ended. I've since had to go back in, but not for the same length of time. And then my mindset's changed to not just focusing on Army life, but to shift over to baseball life.
Got it. Okay. So you coached Hanukkah for your son. How old is your son, Ori?
So my son Ori, so at the time he was in fourth grade and he was 9 years old. He's now 10.
Got it. Okay. And you're setting a goal for that summer to go to the Little League World Series
Yes.
in Poland.
So I have an older son, Eitan, who is, he actually recently has bar mitzvah, but over the summer he was 12 years old.
Okay.
And so the goal was to go with my older son, Eitan, to the Little League World Series tournament, which is held in Kutno, Poland.
It's all,
Now,
is it always there?
so the qualifiers slash regional tournaments are always held there. And the goal for every team who's there is to win the whole tournament and then go to Williamsport, Pennsylvania, to the actual Little League World Series. And I'm sure many of your viewers are familiar with the Little League World Series because it's a really big deal in the United States. It's on ESPN. I remember even as a kid on the news, we would hear about what was going on in the Little League World Series. So it's a major baseball tournament, major youth sports tournament. And so that was our goal for Israel to get there. Now, I'm not going to get too lost in the nuances of how Little League works, but it's not just a national tournament, meaning you don't just say, let me take the best players of your country and then they send them. It's basically the best players from your local league. They make, let's call it the All-Star team. And then the All-Star team plays in all sorts of games and tournaments until they move up the ranks and eventually get to Williamsport where they have the Little League World Series. Now, in Israel, there isn't that much baseball.
Right.
So our tournaments are, it's not like the United States where you've got by thousands of teams initially competing and moving up the ranks. We're just, a few teams who are competing. I was the manager of the team that went in 2023, and I was also this year back with the team this year as a coach. And so we go back to Kutno, which is a city in Poland, to try to see this year if we can make it to the Little League World Series.
How many teams are showing up to Kutno, Poland for this?
So there's two, the way it works is there's 2 weeks. The first week is called the regional tournament. It's basically meant for teams that are not known to be particularly strong. In 2023, at that tournament, there were eight teams, of which four got to advance. And then of And then for the second week, which is called the regional tournament, I think there were seven or eight teams. This year it was a little bit different. There were seven teams that went to the first week, of which two advanced. And in the second week, there were 11 teams that automatically qualified. So between the 2 weeks, you're talking about 18 teams that are all trying to get there, and only one is left standing at the end. And so it's hard to get there. The odds are definitely stacked against you, especially with us as a team that had to do 2 weeks, because the first year we went there in 2023, it was the first year Israel had gone in many, many years. And so we went 2-1 in pool play before losing our playoff game. So we didn't end up advancing to the second week. So that meant this year we had to once again be in that first week in what's called the qualifier tournament. And we were seven teams there, and we were told, listen, you have to be one of the top two teams in order to advance. So the numbers didn't look great, but this is where the story really gets awesome. The way we played in the tournament was just unbelievable.
Well, good. Let's use that as a cliffhanger because I'm really interested, but take a quick break before that and then people will come right back.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance, creating an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anyone for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit israelthemiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
Okay, David, your story is getting unbelievable. What's happening in Poland?
So as I said before, only two out of seven teams can advance. So I'm there with my two co-coaches. There's Mordechai Holtz from Efrat, from Gush Etzion. And then there was Michael Levy from Tel Aviv. And so we have to game plan, how are we going to be one of the top two teams standing? And we have 14 kids who are with us. So first game we have is Sunday, July 7th, and we face a team from Poland. We saw them practice a little bit beforehand. We said they have some good players, but they don't seem to be like a great team. We felt that we should be able to beat them. We're the away team. So for any non-baseball fan, that just means we're the team that comes to bat first. And I have to say, I've never seen an offensive barrage the way I saw in that first inning. We scored a whopping 17 runs.
Wow.
It was against his team from Poland.
Poland, wow.
And my son was batting 10th when he came up. So some of you may be asking, how is he batting 10th? I thought there's nine men in the lineup. When it comes to Little League, you have 12 to 14 man rosters, and everyone on the roster has to be in the lineup. So part of our strategy, while he's a good hitter, we wanted to make sure we had good hitters at the bottom of the lineup. So he came up 10th, and the story I always tell is that he drew a walk. Okay, so it's nothing, to write home about, but he came up with only one out. Every single kid before him had gotten a hit. Meaning sometimes when you watch little kid baseball, you say, listen, the reason he scored so many runs is because the pitcher from the other team couldn't pitch, he couldn't throw strikes, and it was just a walk-a-thon. Here, everything they were throwing at us, they were throwing good pitches, and we were just hitting constantly and just rocking it. So I said we were up 17-0 after the first inning. And when all was said and done, we won 25-2 in three innings, because that's when the mercy rule kicks in. And even though we had like a whole game plan for which pitchers to use, at some point we were just saying, you know what, whatever pitcher we have at the bottom of our depth chart, put him in, save our better pitchers for the next tournaments. Because part of youth baseball is you can't use your same pitcher over and over, would wreck their arm. So you have to, strategize how you're using your pitchers. And so even the pitchers towards the bottom of our depth chart were still, fine, and they were getting the outs. And it was just like, wow, we We really made a statement on day one.
I just want to clarify something. You're saying depth, DEPTH, not death, DEATH,
Depth,
right?
yeah, with a P, yes, yeah. We're
Okay.
pitching depth means you have a lot of guys on your roster who can pitch effectively. So it's not just, a couple of kids who are relied on if you want to win the games.
Got it.
So that was part of our strategy. So the next day we faced Estonia, and they were a team that won by 19 runs in their first game. So we figured, oh, okay, they must be a pretty strong team. Now, when I watched their game, I saw they were winning because the other team had a pitcher who couldn't really pitch, and there was just lots of walks, and they were taking advantage, and that's why they won by so many runs. So I felt, okay, it should be a closer game, but nevertheless, in the first inning, we must have scored something like 10 runs and just came out really strong. The pitching was fine. Like we shut them out in the first inning. We were the home team, and we were up 15-0 at the end of, I guess it was at the end of the second inning, and then we shut them out again in the third inning, and that was it because we had the 15-run lead. We once again won by mercy rule. So by this point in the tournament, all of the teams are looking at us like, "Whoa, who are these guys from Israel who are just like obliterating everyone?" I could even say one of the challenges I had as a coach is, when you're coaching little kids, you have to always remember that they're little kids, okay? And you don't want to like completely, embarrass the other team. You don't want to like make the kids so hate baseball. They're like, oh, this is stupid. I want to leave. I don't want to play anymore. So one of the things that we did in both of our first two games was we said, once we're up by a certain number of runs, even though there aren't even three outs, we're just going to tell the umpires we're stopping the inning, we're switching sides. So like
Really?
after yeah, so after the in the first game when we're the away team, we scored 17 in the first inning before they got three outs. Okay, because we hadn't even pitched yet. In fact, my son, who was the starting pitcher, so Eitan was starting that day. I wasn't even sure, do I put him in as pitcher? Because we told him, yeah, you're going to start. We let him pitch. He shut them out in the first inning, with ease. But, after that point, we said, look, our goal is to make sure each of our kids bats three times, and that's it. So like in the second inning, we scored four or five runs, whatever it was. And I just signaled to the umpire, look, we're up by like 20 something runs. That's it. We're done. We're switching sides. And we did that again in the third inning. So I actually had to do that, both in that game. And I believe I did that again in the game against Estonia because I didn't want the kids on the losing team. Like, obviously, we have to win, but I don't want the kids in the losing team to feel devastated beyond belief. So anyway, that brings us to the third game we had, which was against a team from Croatia, which was actually a very strong team.
Before we go into Croatia, let's just take a step back. You're in Poland with a bunch of Jewish kids from Israel, 7, 9 months into a war. In current news, we're seeing Israeli sports fans literally getting beaten in European cities. Poland is a place that, as much as, for eternity, Poland will always have the scar of being a place where Jews were not well treated at best, and in which millions of Jews were murdered during the Holocaust. What were the parents of the kids thinking? What additional necessary security precautions? You didn't just pick up and go to Poland.
Yes, so a lot of good questions there. One of our concerns as coaches before we even flew was, are these parents okay with their kids traveling abroad in general? Poland in particular, because of the history, not necessarily what's going on today, but the history. It's such a bad history. There could be some parents who would say, I don't know. Thankfully, we found a really great group of kids. The kids were great. The parents are great. Obviously, they were very good baseball players. So on that front, we were good. And in terms of security, so we did have security guards. We used a company that also, I think, does like March of the Living type trips and other Jewish trips to Poland. So we had security guards who were very familiar with Jews. For them, it was a very different trip because normally when they protect a Jewish group, they're going to concentration camps and death camps and the ghettos and all of that type of stuff. These guys have told us they're like, we've done many of these trips. We've never once done a baseball tournament. So for them, it was definitely a different experience, but the guards themselves were fantastic. And we spoke with the Little League officials beforehand, and they were very clear there is like no tolerance of any anti-Semitism, any anti-Israel sentiment. Meaning, we even said, like, what happens if we're at a game and someone starts yelling, from the river to the sea or some nonsense like that? They said, yeah, we would just kick them out of the game, kick them off the campus, they're done. Like, we're not tolerating that. There's, we're
That's
here for kids to
encouraging.
play baseball and nothing, no political statement. You want to make a political statement? Find some other venue.
Okay. And there were no instances?
Thank God we didn't have anything, definitely nothing major. One of the kids said that a kid from another team said free Palestine. I had some suspicions just because this kid didn't speak any English, so I was curious how they understood, what he was saying. I don't know. But definitely no major incidences. And thank God we were safe the entire time. The Little League people were great. The security we were assigned was great. So
Right.
we
Okay.
got through that without a hitch. So going to the game
Now,
against
right, now
Croatia.
you're in Croatia. Yeah.
So the Croatian team we knew was going to be a strong team. We saw the way they played against their other teams; they were good. We also, because of the strategy, knew we were going to make it to the playoffs, and where we had to win our playoff game. So we had to set our pitching rotation so that we had our top pitchers available for the next day. Because if they
Okay.
pitch too much, then they can't pitch. So we our game plan worked perfectly. We ended up winning this game 9-0, and our pitching depth was fantastic. In fact, the pitcher we brought in towards the end of the game, we decided not to use him for the final day, but he throws very, very hard. And we were friendly with the Croatian coaches, and they looked at us as like, we brought in this pitcher, and we're on our bench, and we're on the third base side, and he's the third base coach, and he just looks at us, and he's like, "Are you guys for real? Like, this kid
Wow.
is throwing bullets out there!" Like, and he was our fourth pitcher of the game. Like, our first three pitchers were all throwing, the minimal so they could pitch the next day, and we're able to get their guys out, and then we bring in our closer who's just like shutting them down. So we end up winning that game 9-0. The last game we played, because we had to play a doubleheader that day, was against a team from Ukraine. Now, it was sad because the team from Ukraine, they were a very, very weak team. Due to the war they have there, they weren't able to practice properly. So we won easily, but honestly, that isn't really what mattered. What really mattered in that case was that both teams were just able to make it, that all of the adults here were able to figure out how do we get our kids together to play a game. We took a really nice picture of the team after both teams together, with our arms
Yeah.
around each other, with each of our flags after the game. And it was just nice because it was a moment for these kids just to be kids and to have fun. And I know what the kids were in Ukraine go through. It sounds like it's even worse than what our kids go through, and what our kids go through isn't easy. So that was a sort of a nice way to end pool play. We then were 4-0 heading into the playoffs. We were the only undefeated team. We had to play Estonia again, which we won easily. I think the final score was 13-1. And when all was said and done in that first week, we outscored our opponent 77-3. Our
Amazing.
big power hitter Moshe from Efrat hit three home runs. Another kid, Lior from Tel Aviv, hit a home run. I think we and when I say home run, like actually crossing the fence. We had other kids who hit inside the park home runs. Our pitching and our defense was just phenomenal. And so there we were. We made it to the second week, which was our minimal goal, to what's called the regional tournament. And this is where we knew we were going to start playing the tough teams. But we said, like, at least our goal was to show we were good enough to make it to the second week. And now, we're that we're there, we'll see how well we can do.
Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better. Much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co,
israelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisraelisra all backgrounds, just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones. Okay.
So our first game was against France. We were in a pool. It was France, the Czech Republic, and South Africa.
Okay.
That was the pool we were in. There are 13 teams, so we were in a pool of four teams. And we were told that you need to be one of the top two teams in order to advance to the playoffs. So that's the number. Those are the numbers we're working with. That's the math we have to play with.
Okay. You had to win.
We had to win. We knew at least two games in order to win. And just to make things challenging for us, the Czech team the year before went to Pennsylvania to the Little League World Series. So we knew these kids are going to be good. The French team we saw the previous year because they were in the first week and they were one of the teams that advanced. And I saw them play and they play a fundamentally good game. And South Africa was a wild card. No one knew what to expect because they'd never come to this tournament before. Okay, so those were the odds we had. Our first game was against France. And we knew that if we're going to advance to the playoffs, we definitely have to beat the French team. And so we ended up squeaking out a 6-5 win. So this is the first game we've played the entire time. That's a close game.
Yeah.
Wasn't always easy. It was one of those heart attack games for all of you baseball fans out there. We had the lead the whole time, but at different points we thought we were going to blow it. And our guys, you know, when it came down to it, we're able to hold them down. We squeaked out that win. And we said, you know what? A win is a win. And it was also good for us to show, hey, even against these good teams, we're able to win. Our next game was against the Czech kids, and I'll tell you, those kids were phenomenal. They ended up actually beating us 10-0. It was a mercy rule game. And I mean, their kids were, all of them were just seemed like such professionals. They just knew exactly what they were doing.
Wow.
It was like they were machines. It was phenomenal to watch them. I mean, for me as a father, one of my highlights was my son Eitan got hit off a kid named Ilya. Now, Ilya had actually played in the Little League World Series the year before. To see my kid actually getting a hit of a kid who played in the Little League World Series was awesome. This kid, Ilya, actually has an amazing story. He's originally from Ukraine, fled to the Czech Republic at the beginning of the war. I don't know if he played baseball at all in Ukraine, but he definitely became really good in the Czech Republic. Long story short, this year, when the team that eventually won, again, was the Czech Republic, he was their starting pitcher in the Little League World Series, and he pitched really well against this Cuban team. And so to see my son was able to get a hit off this amazing pitcher was like a really just a great feeling, even though it was a game we lost.
Okay.
And that brings us to our last game of the pool play, which is against South Africa. They took an early lead on us, but then our pitching, you know, settled down. We were able to hold them down. And I think it was the third inning, we just exploded for 8 runs. Our kid Moshe from Efrat, who was our big home run hitter, just hit a bomb off this kid and from South Africa. And they never really recovered. The final score was 11-4. We ended up 2-1. And because, you know, basically the Czech won all of their games, we beat, you know, France and South Africa, and France won their game. So we ended up in second place and we're going to the playoffs, which was a shock because before this tournament, no one gave us a second thought. And now we're there with the top six teams. Now here's where we run into a problem. Because of the way the tournament is scheduled, the quarterfinals are on Friday. The semifinals are scheduled for Shabbat, for Saturday, and then Sunday is the championship game. So we have a problem. We're the sixth seed. We have to play the three seed. What happens if we win that game? Do we now have to play on Saturday, and we have a team which is almost all religious kids, and we even asked the parents, are you comfortable? And the majority of them said, no, we're not going to play on Saturday. So
religious
what do we do?
Kids, again, just for people who are following who aren't Jewish, religious kids mean that they're Orthodox. It means that Shabbat is not a game day. Shabbat, we're not traveling. Shabbat, it's a limiting of all forms of work, including competitive sports.
Right. And there is an interesting question in Jewish law. Is there even a problem to play on Saturday or not? But whether you say it's permitted or not, there's a certain feeling it's definitely against the spirit of Shabbat. And so people are saying, even if it's technically not against the law, it's against the spirit and we don't want our kids doing. So we have a problem. What happens if we win? So we worked this out with Little League. And again, the Little League officials were really great there. And we said, here's what we want to do. We proposed and they accepted. We said, if we lose, this doesn't become relevant. But if we win our quarterfinal game and advance to the semis, rather than playing on Saturday, we want to play on Friday, okay? Meaning a doubleheader for us. And the team we would face, which was the team from Germany, they were to only play that one game, and they would clearly have an advantage over us because there are all
Yeah.
sorts of restrictions about pitching kids in doubleheaders. Plus, we just play would have had played 6 innings, and because Little League is a 6-inning game, it's not 9 innings. We would played 6 innings and then have to play again a few hours later. The German coaches, who I became very friendly with, they were amazing guys. They were said, absolutely, we respect your religious beliefs. They had no problem with it. Little League, was fine with it. So okay, so there we were going to the quarterfinals, but we had to face a team from Spain, and these kids were very good. They were, first of all, they were just big. You look at these kids, they're like, wow, they're like bigger than me. But we saw them play in their pool play games, and they won first place in their pool. They were really just a very strong team, and I think most people did not give us a chance. Like they said, you guys aren't gonna win. So my son Eitan, he was the starting pitcher for us in this game. He gave up an unearned run in the first inning, so we go down 1-0. But he's able to hold it. Our defense was good. They were able to make outs every time the Spanish kids put the ball in play. And then in the third inning, our guys just exploded, and we got, I think, 4 runs. We end up extending it to a 7-run lead in the sixth, and Eitan is just dominating. And by the time, we have to take him out, we're up 7-1. We end up winning the game 7-4. So we go to the semifinals. Unfortunately, from there, we didn't have the luck, and we ended up losing to the German team. But we were 2 wins away from making it to the Little League World Series.
Would you think it would have been different if you didn't have to do the doubleheader?
It definitely would have changed our game plan, that's for sure. I mean, the team from Germany was good. Hard to say because we actually had a lead at one point in the game, but then we weren't able to hold it. But it's one of those things we'll never know. I don't for a moment regret the decision because we were able to stay true to our values as Jews and true to our sport. That was the best we
So,
could do. And so it is what it is.
when we were talking about setting a time for this, of course, the memory of Sandy Koufax, what was it, 1956? What year did he
Oh
skip?
no, I think it was le no, he was younger than I think it was either 63 or 65 when the Dodgers they won the World Series both years. One of those years he took off for Yom Kippur.
Right. So he didn't play. So you said that, I like how you said it. But does we include the kids? Were all the kids on board, or like, nah,
Yeah,
that's
the
going to be
kids.
really hard. It's August in Poland. It's hot here. It's humid. Can't we rest? Was that or not at all? That wasn't even a conversation.
The kids were always on board for whatever the plan was. At some point, we realized they had faith in the coaches. We said, look, we have a plan to help get us to the Little League World Series. I'm not guaranteeing it's going to work, but it's going to be a good plan. We were able to get to the semifinals. So even after we lost, I think most of the kids realized, look, this was what it was. They understood we don't play on Shabbat because we're Jews. They got it. Were some kids maybe a little upset? It's possible, but the sense I got was they realized what they were doing was, big picture stuff. And so they realized the value of what they did.
And that's, by the way, you and I are here for a long time. It's been 21 years since I had any of my kids play in any sports in America, and we lived in a town where, because of the large number of Orthodox Jews, there was an option for Jewish kids not to play sports on Shabbat. But in most of the United States, where their Jewish kids want to play sports and maintain their religious practice and not violate Shabbat and its traditions, without going into a whole conversation, people who are listening to this need to understand that that's a conflict that Jews live with all over the world.
Yes, it's a dilemma we always have, and it's something that's also not going away. It's something that'll always exist, and we have to embrace it as Jews. So that brings me, I guess, to the next goal I had since I left Jenin. And one of the things I said to myself is, I run the program Incarnation Ron, the baseball program Incarnation Ron, and I came back and I realized just how much baseball meant to me. And I realized one of the reasons it means so much to me is because I see how much good it does for the kids. There's no greater feeling I get as a coach than seeing a kid who struggled all year trying to make contact with the ball. And then finally, he's able to get a big hit to help the team win a game. Or a kid who really struggles controlling his emotions, who finally be able to put it all together, control himself, and you know what? Pitch a really good inning for the team and help us out. And so one of the things that I started doing is we have a project now in Carne Shomrom where we're trying to raise money for a baseball field because, you know, in times of war, it's very easy to say, you know what, there's a war going on. How do I give to the war effort? And as someone who personally benefited from a lot of those fundraisers, my helmet, my vest, et cetera, those things came from those donations. So I very much appreciate it. On the other hand, I also realize there is a home front and there are a lot of kids who sort of get neglected and they get forgotten about during this. And so we decide we're going to start a campaign to see what we can do for the kids who are left behind on the home front and try to raise some money for them to help build a baseball field here in the Shomron. Yes.
Where's the closest field to Carne Shomron? Where do they play now?
So we right now we play like there's for the really young kids who are able to play in the smaller areas, we have what's called a mini pitch soccer field. But
Okay.
for the older kids who don't have a real place, we find ourselves practicing on the basketball court, or we have a field that's just covered in weeds. Sometimes they practice there. We can't even host games because it's not a real field, so they drive about a half an hour to the Baptist village. It's in Petah Tikva, and that's where they play their game. So if there's no traffic, it's half an hour. If there's traffic, we sit in traffic, and then takes about 45 minutes to get there. But that's what we often have to do for our home games. Like leave aside our away games, which obviously we have to travel for. So it's definitely a challenge that we've had, and we've been able to produce some really great players. Even though we don't have the right facilities for them, I could keep
Wow.
thinking if we actually had the right facilities and I could really train them properly with a batting cage, you know, with a field with artificial turf and not just weeds, you know, coming up through the ground,
Yeah.
we could do amazing things.
Very nice. Okay. And the town, Carne Shomron, is giving is got the land for you?
Yeah, we have a plot of land. It's at the entrance to the community. We're going to do a split field between us and soccer. Unfortunately, there isn't enough baseball in our town to
Sure.
fully fill up, but we have enough kids. We have, you know, dozens of kids who play baseball, but there's still hundreds who play soccer because it's still the main sport in the country. So we're doing a joint project with them. So we have a land. The city council is behind it. And so it's definitely something we're all pushing for together.
You just have to raise a little bit of money.
Just a little bit. The entire cost to build a field is about 4 million shekels, which in dollars comes out to a little bit over $1 million, which is even more money than I make in a day. Yeah, it's something we're working towards. And in Israel, baseball, I feel like, is definitely a growing sport. And I've seen, you know, kids who just all over the country who would get into it. And once they realize the magic of baseball, they're hooked. And it's
Yeah.
something, you know, I want to spread around the country as much as I can.
Very nice. So you and I spoke about this before leading in, and I'm very pleased. You know, it's something that I had to give consideration to because I'm not going to stretch the integrity of what we do, but people will see here in the show notes an opportunity to donate to that. One of the calculations you see with Genesis 123 Foundation is building bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel. And I think you just made a you made a good case is that kids need to be able on when the in, even in a war, kids need to be able to be as normal as possible in the home front. And for you coming home, that just being able to coach that game during Hanukkah a year ago, that was a important event and reprieve for you. So what's nice about it is while we do have people following Inspiration from Zion literally from all over the world, heavily in North America and plus other countries where baseball is not foreign. And so I'm hoping that people will step up and or step to the plate. I guess probably that's where the term comes from, and will contribute that we can also be part of that and then continue to see obviously growth in Carne Shomron, but growth of baseball and continued acceptance of Israeli kids playing baseball in this tournament in Poland against teams from all over the world. Maybe that can be in one way a light unto the nations that we're mandated to be.
And my blessing for your audience is that hopefully one day we'll raise enough money, we'll have a field, and they can come to Israel, to Carne Shomron, and actually see the field once it's done.
See the field, and maybe we'll put a tour together. Baseball in Israel,
That would be
baseball.
awesome.
Yeah, that'll be amazing. Okay, David, I love how the conversation's gone. I thank you. I'm glad we did this. Before I sign off and say goodbye to you and our listeners, what have we not covered that we want to?
I think we basically covered everything. I told him my experience from the time I was called up on October 7th till now. I told the baseball story, the combat experience I had in the northern Samaria. So I think I got everything in.
Good. Okay. God willing, this will be the beginning of some more stories to tell. David Weiss, thank you for joining. And whether it's for future political conversations or achieving the next goal of that baseball field there, I look forward to
Always
having
a
you.
pleasure.
Yeah. So always, friends, if you've been following Inspiration from Zion for the last number of years, for the last three at least, we've had this great program going on. None of you can see my bookshelf, but it's called From Jonathan's Bookshelf. And all we ask that you do is share, like, or comment on the link to this program. And every month we pick one person at random to receive a book from Jonathan's Bookshelf. Now, full disclosure, for the last, oh, I say 14 or 15 months, we have been offering exclusively the magnificent Israel the Miracle book, which we, the Genesis 123 Foundation, published just before the war began. It's a $75 value. It's stunning. It's inspiring. If you want to get a copy on your own, you can go to inspirationfromzion at gmail.com and reach me. But inspiration from Zion. Oh, sorry, I'm confusing people. Israelthemiracle.com is the website. You can go there and get a book, or you can be in touch with us. But all we're asking for you to do is share, comment, or like this episode, and we're going to pick one person at random to get a copy of the book. We're always grateful this podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. I'm sure there's Little League Baseball somewhere in Culpeper. If you're ever in the area following baseball or anything else, stop in and thank them for helping make this conversation possible. And special thanks to the Coyne family as well for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all the Genesis 123 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue dialogues like this and build bridges. If you'd like to sponsor an episode in honor or memory of a loved one or special occasion, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your comments always as part of a dialogue, and especially about traditional Judaism for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Please share this with others who also find it of interest, and please continue to join us right here as we give you more meaningful conversations about Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy, and I send my blessings from right here in the Judean mountains. God bless you.
Hallelujah. Al-Mashiach.